welcome to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis. Now, here's your host, DeAndrew.
And welcome to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, also broadcast live on UPRN 105.5 New Orleans. I'm your host, DeAndrew, and tonight my guest is Michael Schrath. I would like to say a quick hello and a thank you to my listeners at the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base of the 754th Electronics Systems Group, and also to thank them for checking out my website. I hope you enjoy this program, and hopefully maybe you'll learn something along the way. And I want to remind everyone that you can also listen to the UFO Paranormal Radio Network on your cell phone simply by calling 704-631-4060 and entering the four-digit station ID code 2899. My guest tonight, Michael Schrath, has lectured across the country on the subject of mystery aircraft and classified propulsion systems buried deep within the military-industrial complex. As a recent guest speaker at the Oshkosh EAA Air Venture 2006-2007 event, which is the world's largest air show, Michael has developed a number of contacts who have had first-hand experience dealing with classified black programs, including former U.S. Air Force pilots, retired Navy personnel, and aerospace engineers who have maintained a top-secret Q-Magic clearance. A private pilot and military aerospace historian, he currently works as an aerospace draftsman near Chicago. I was privileged to meet Michael in person at this year's UFO Crash Conference in Las Vegas, and I am pleased and honored to welcome Michael Schrath as my guest this evening. Michael, the presentation you gave at Las Vegas, I thought was very impressive. And then viewing the DVD that you gave us on a lecture you gave on military aircraft, had David and I both fascinated. How did you get started into doing this?
Well, Dee, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to join you on the program today. Thank you so much. I've always had an interest in unusual aircraft. I was always kind of an inquisitive mind, wanting to know where our tax dollars were disappearing for the past 40 years. So I started tracking down engineers, test pilots, former Lockheed Skunk Works, senior project design engineers, and that's kind of how I started this whole process and started connecting the dots, finding out where the black budget is filtering to, and that's how I got started with this.
Oh, interesting. And you'll for the UFO end of this, you went through a lot of the reports records.
Yes, absolutely. It's my personal assessment that 95% of what people are reporting as extraterrestrial vehicles are, in point of fact, our own deep black programs. The remaining 5% represent the core of reality of this phenomenon.
Do you consider that 5% as being extraterrestrial?
That's exactly the percentage that I wanted to follow up with on my presentation at the Crash Retrieval Conference, because those cases are too important and they are just too significant to deny or delay following up on. And so that was the whole point of a 3-year intensive investigation at the Center for UFO Studies at 2457 West Peterson Avenue in Chicago, and pulling out only the best cases that had documented paperwork to go along with the case, and most importantly, an illustration that was definitely linked to that case. From that point, I created an AutoCAD drawing, a technical line drawing, and from that line drawing, I created a 3D SolidWorks rendering, and that was the result there.
And I have to say, the renderings that you showed at both the Crash Conference and on the DVD you gave us, they're amazing. You did an awesome job with that.
I've had help from a lot of different people that have kind of come together on this, so I cannot take credit for everything here. But certainly, you know, I felt that since so many of these cases were lost and forgotten and stepped on and left for dead and completely lost to history, these things hadn't been seen in over 40 years, it would be a really good idea to perhaps bring these back out into the light and perhaps breathe some new life into these old cases.
Oh, fantastic idea. I have to admit that several of the cases that you talked about there in Las Vegas were ones that I had never heard of, and some of them were cases I had, but it was really nice having a color rendering visual of what these people were seeing.
Absolutely. I think the visual aid is so important, so powerful to get ideas across. It's actually more important than in many cases than just the text itself. So,
your entire presentation at Las Vegas was visual.
Correct.
With
yes.
You telling the story behind the visuals.
Exactly.
Also, I'd like to let everyone know that since Michael is focusing mainly on the visual end of it, if you go to my website, which is www.eyetothesky.net, that's E-Y-E, the number 2, thesky.net, and underneath Michael's bio, you will see two links. For the first hour, we will be covering the secret aircraft, and there's some photographs, or pictures, rather, that you've supplied for this evening's program. And I have to say, they're very impressing.
One thing I'd like to state right up front is what we're going to be covering today and the illustrations that are posted on the website are computer-generated forensic composite illustrations to give people an idea of what these craft look like. They're not actually intended to be or understood as authentic U.S. Air Force photographs, so I just want to make that right up front.
I appreciate you correcting me. I have a tendency to do that sometimes.
Oh, no, that's fine. I just want to be completely honest up front with everybody. So, you know, some of these birds are still classified, and yet, it represents no threat to the national security to declassify some of these aircraft, but they refuse to do it. So what we're left with is just putting together the best forensic illustration that we can do and then bringing that out into the public domain and having a coalition of information coming together, and that's the point of the illustration.
Well, fantastic. On this first picture, I almost said photograph, but it's the
right
photographer in me, you know, I keep wanting to say photograph. the first picture.
Right. Yes, let me try to set the landscape of what I'd like to cover this evening. First of all, we are going to be covering the U.S. Air Force Jet Flying Wing Disc Program stationed at MacDill Air Force Base, September 1967. We'll be covering the ARV, that's the Alien Reproduction Vehicle, also known as the Flux Liner, that was temporarily based at Norton Air Force Base, November the 12th, 1988, during a open house gathering military exhibit. We'll be covering the Boeing Phantom Works Bird of Prey that was declassified October 2002 under the Bush administration. We'll be covering the Pulsar that was also at the Norton display. We'll be considering the Superstall, the same display type aircraft. Sneaky Pete, that's a very interesting story. We'll be covering Black Star. We'll highlight the Flying Triangle, the Hudson Valley case, the F-19 that was seen by a Learjet pilot back in 1986. We'll be covering the Illinois Flying Triangle, the RAF Boscombe Down incident, the Manta Ray, the East German Flying Triangle, and also the TR-3B. I also think it's important that we cover the significant statements made by former head of Lockheed Skunk Works, Ben Rich. That's extremely important. We need to cover three test pilots: Joseph Lanny, we need to cover Dennis Bone Sager, also we need to highlight Daniel Vanderhorst. These are three test pilots that we'll be considering. Also, we're going to get into the six UFO cases also published on that link, and then we're going to have, if we have any time at all, we're going to try to spend just a few minutes on Bob Lazar and Roswell. So that's kind of the landscape of what I'd like to cover this evening.
Oh, you pricked my ears up when you said Roswell.
Yep.
And I'm not aware of a connection between Lear or Bazaar and Roswell.
They're technically, if you really deduce what Bob is talking about, there is a connection. There is a connection. It's a little tangent, but there is a connection. I don't think it's been talked about too much. So if we have any time left over, we'll hit that too. So.
Oh,
yes.
Boy, we're going to have to fly through this then.
Yes. Okay, so let's begin at the first illustration. To make a really long story short in the interest of time here, a retired naval combat veteran by the name of Jack D. Pickett, who is now deceased, he was a good friend of mine. He was a really good guy. He was the NCO Club newsletter publisher. He was a gunner's mate on a destroyer in the Pacific during World War II. Anyway, he was driving down the perimeter base road at MacDill Air Force Base, and his business associate, a man by the name of Harold Baker, who I have never been able to find. I could never find this gentleman. They were both driving down the road at MacDill Air Force Base, and to his shock and surprise, parked on the opposite side of the chain link fence at MacDill, which is 7 miles south of Tampa, Florida, Jack saw four of the most amazing aircraft that he had ever seen before. They measured 20, 40, 70, and 116 feet in diameter. They all had tricycle landing gear. They had control surfaces located along the circumference of the disc. There was a crew compartment or pilot compartment located dead center on the upper portion of the disc. A fuselage tapered back to the aft end of the disc, which terminated in a large vertical stabilizer. There was one air intake on either side of the pilot's compartment, and again, this had tricycle landing gear. Most of these aircraft, they looked identical, but they just had different sizes for the diameter of the discs. The largest craft, the 116-foot diameter vehicle, the port main landing gear, the left main landing gear, was partially collapsed, so the whole thing was leaning at a 10-degree angle to the left side. So after seeing this, Jack was absolutely amazed at what he was looking at. This was an actual U.S. Air Force jet flying wing disc program. Now, that particular model suffered from stability problems, and so they were scrapping these at the base scrapyard. And that's why they were there. And so Jack was, he was actually given access to get near these vehicles. He kicked the tires on the 40-foot disc. He was, a photograph of him kicking the tires of the 40-foot disc was taken by an official Air Force photographer. And he asked about the story. He wanted to know what the background of these discs were. And eventually he was given access to the general, who took him into an armed guard facility at MacDill Air Force Base on the second floor. This was a private armed guard library. And the general who was giving Jack the briefing at this very interesting meeting, he proceeded to pull open this large file drawer and started laying out hundreds of officially stamped U.S. Air Force photographs of these aircraft in flight, on the tarmac, parked in hangars, in flight with F-84 Thunder jets and F-86 Sabre jet fighter interceptor aircraft. And Jack started asking all of these questions. He wanted to know how fast, how high, what was the performance specifications. And the general told him, quote, "We could fly so fast as to attain sufficient altitude to be classified as achieving space flight." That was a direct quote. So the question is, did these craft have a secondary propulsion system beyond just the jet engines, the air intakes that you could see on these vehicles? That may be one reason why these aircraft still are classified to this day.
And it's surprising. I agree. It is surprising that they're still classified when they were basically a failure.
Yeah, they definitely suffered from stability problems, and they were scrapping that particular model in favor of the VTOL versions that they produced later on. And that's the second part of the story is Just as Jack was preparing a article for his NCO Club newsletter, it was going to be called, this is the actual title of the article, it was going to be Flying Saucers for Real! Exclamation point. That was the actual title of the article. And during a Saturday night flyover of downtown Miami, one of these DTOL craft that took off from Avon Park. Now, Avon Park is more of a gunnery range than anything else. There's no long runways there. But this thing had a propulsion system malfunction, dropped down to treetop level, flew over downtown Miami at extremely high speed. The next morning, it was all over the news. It was on the Tampa Tribune newspaper. So Jack picked up that Tampa Tribune newspaper, brought it into the general's office, and basically said, you know, I think we've got a problem here, because on one side, you are getting ready to declassify these discs at the base scrapyard, and then on the other side, you're getting ready, you are denying the existence of this craft that just flew over Miami. What do you want to do about it? So the general excused himself. He contacted the Secretary of the Air Force, the Secretary of Defense, the head of Strategic Air Command in Nebraska, and it came down from the highest echelons of government to delay publication, and that's where the story died in 1967.
Wow.
But this was a real flying saucer program that the Air Force was involved in. Now, if it was just Jack Pickett, I wouldn't have much of a story, because in these cases, you need a secondary, redundant, independent verification to authenticate the case. I was able to hook up with a gentleman by the name of Warren Botts. He's a retired P-40 Warhawk pilot who flew Flying Tigers during World War II. He was at a reunion of the Flying Tigers at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base back in 1966. The wives were with the pilots for this reunion, and they were bused across the base to Hangar Number 4, which has five bays, A, B, C, D, and E. Roosevelt's DC-6 was in Bay D. There's a connecting doorway that runs the length of these hangars, and Warren actually wandered into the last hangar, which is Bay E. This is back in 1966, and parked nose first in that hangar was the identical 116-foot flying saucer aircraft that Jack Pickett had seen 1 year later. So I was able to independently verify that this was a real aircraft.
I didn't know they had another, you know, location for these planes.
Apparently they were in Texas too, but MacDill was definitely one location. There was an Air Force base in Texas that I believe they were also there. But that's all that Jack relayed to me. Clearly, they probably were at multiple different locations, but those are the only two that he knew of personally.
Was there anybody else who reported these as well?
Well, it was reported in that newspaper article. There was a squadron of jet fighter interceptors that carried the designation FLITAF. And that is believed to stand for Fighter Long Range Tactical Interceptor, something like that. There was a FLITAF designation of support liaison aircraft that flew with these, and that was some of the photographs that Jack saw in those black and white shots that he saw at MacDill. So there are people involved with this program. So what I did is I extrapolated that data. I hooked it up to what we know about the NEPA program. That's the Nuclear Energy for Propulsion of Aircraft program, and the AANP, Aircraft Nuclear Propulsion Program. Now, these were financed by the Atomic Energy Commission, by the United States Navy, and by the U.S. Air Force. And, you know, by 1960, they had already spent $800 million on research and development. And what's interesting is, if you look at the literature, if you look at the Air Force literature back in 1955, you'll notice that there's all this talk about atomic-powered aircraft and nuclear-powered spaceships, but by 1960, all that subject matter was completely expunged from the aerospace literature. So I personally believe that the research and development of these nuclear-powered aircraft began in 1950, they made the breakthrough in 1960, and then this whole thing went black.
Speaking of these nuclear-powered aircraft, the question has come to me through Pal Talk here, asking if you have ever talked about nuclear craft with Stanton Friedman.
Technically, no, I have not. I have not. But I did speak to a retired GE engineer. He had been working at GE for 30 years. This guy was very brilliant. And he relayed a story to me that there was a program going on at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base back in 1960. So we're talking the same time frame. He was working on a 40-foot diameter flying saucer that had a bubble canopy on top. He said that there were Boeing engineers also involved in this program. And he said that there were four big landing gear struts coming down, and each of the landing gear struts was connected to six wheels. So you can see that, you know, this was a rather substantial craft here. And so I asked him, what in the world would you need these big, robust landing gear struts for? What could you possibly need that? I asked him, was this cargo? Was it a cargo aircraft? He said, no. And I said, was this for the provisions for long-range fuel reserves? And he said, no. And I could sense that he was beginning to lose it with me. And so I thought very quickly what they were doing at that time. And it was the nuclear program that came to mind. And I said, what about the shielding? Is that why this thing was so heavy and needed those big, robust struts? He said, yep, that's it. And that's exactly what they were doing at that time. So there's another verification of that program.
Wow. Yep. Everything I've ever heard of the nuclear-powered, you know, aircraft.
They have made the breakthrough. I'm convinced they have made the breakthrough. Now, I definitely want to give people an idea and a direction to go in where you can track this. You know, I'm not just making any of this up. Regarding the black budget, we should spend just a minute on this. Detroit Free Press, February 8, 1987, front page article says, secret ledger hides military projects. Pentagon black budget has tripled under the Reagan administration. Now, page 2 of that article has a very interesting chart. They break this down to the procurement and increase in spending of the black budget. For 1981, it was just over $500 million. By 1988, it was way beyond $9 billion. Federal spending by category. This is for fiscal year 1988. For the environment, we spent $14 billion. For education, we spent $25 billion. For agriculture, it was $26 billion. But for the Pentagon's black budget, well over $35 billion was spent. So I'm asking the question, is there a mismanagement of funding going on here? I mean, we have bridges crumbling and we have schools that could operate more efficiently. We could be putting more teachers in there, but yet, nope, that's not what the government does. They want to have the most efficient weapons delivery platform, and so now we're spending billions on classified black budget funding with no congressional oversight and no public scrutiny at all.
Oh, I agree with that. That sentiment is completely after hearing just recently on the news here in Arizona that Arizona's the state just doesn't have the money, and so they're going to be cutting spending on education and unemployment.
Absolutely. The chart goes on here. For fiscal year 1988, there was a total of $51.1 billion spent, of which the Air Force's black budget was $19.1 billion. So that is the number to keep in mind. Now, the other quick thing to consider, too, is how can American taxpayers track these black programs? Since we're taxpayers, we own those aircraft. Those are our aircraft. It's not owned by the U.S. Air Force. It's owned by the American taxpayer. And every January, the Department of Defense hands an interesting document to Congress, and you can get this at the Library of Congress. It's done every January. It's the Department of Defense budget report. The document to get is called the RDT&E Programs R1. That stands for Research, Development, Test, and Evaluation Programs R1. And what this is it is a rather boring 24-page line item document that describes, you know, how much was spent on different programs. They give you a program element number. They talk about F-16 operations. They talk about B-52 operations. They talk about electronic countermeasures. But then when you further go into this document, deeper into this document, you start running across these really interesting code names like Constant Help, Seek Eagle, Forest Green, Senior Year. Not only do they not tell you what the details of the program is, they don't tell you how much was spent. So what you do is you take the total amount, you subtract the knowns, and what you're left with is the Pentagon's black budget. That's how you track these programs.
Yes. There was a question in the virtual auditorium. We'd like to know the name of that report again.
Okay, the name of the report, it's handed out every January to Congress. You can get this at the Library of Congress right in back of the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. It's called RDT&E. That stands for Research, Development, Test, and Evaluation Programs R1. And it's available to American taxpayers and the world. We have a right to see where our tax dollars are going. And it's very powerful. Now, you can't figure out any real big secrets here, but you can find out where your tax dollars are going. The black programs are completely unacknowledged. You cannot determine any specific details, but this, you know, goes a long way to giving at least, you know, the American public an idea of where their money is being spent. You know, that's what our founding forefathers had placed in checks and balances in the formation of this republic. It's our constitutional right and obligation to question authority.
In order to get all of this in this evening, yes. I'm really kind of interested in hearing about this next photograph. Here I go, the photographer in me is saying photograph. This next image
right.
on the website, the Marine Corps.
Okay, yes, we're going to consider that one. Now, on November the 12th, 1988, this is 2 days after the F-117 was basically released into the public domain. Okay, November the 12th, 1988, there was an open house air show exhibit. This is San Bernardino International Airport now, but at the time it was Norton Air Force Base. And IFR conditions prevailed at the time, so there wasn't really good weather. The Thunderbird pilots who were attempting a display, they had to cancel it. They had to cancel the display because of the low cloud bank. And while everyone was watching the Thunderbirds, there was another exhibit taking place inside what's called the Big Hangar at Norton Air Force Base. And this was a very interesting exhibit to garner support for black programs. We know that Congressman George E. Brown Jr. was present. We know that Senator Alan Cranston was present. We know that high-level military brass was present. Now, in this display, in this large hangar, there were a multitude of classified aircraft, and in front of every aircraft there was a plaque, just like you would see at any air museum, but this was an exhibit of just one-off prototypes. And each plaque had a description of performance specifications, power plant, wingspan. One of these aircraft that was part of this display is what we have termed the Super Stall. That's the aircraft that you're looking with the Marine insignia. Now, the whole bottom story of this is this vehicle or this aircraft had a crew of one. It used off-the-shelf F-16's head-up display. It had a conventional tail arrangement. It had two miniature turbofan jet engines, which tapered back to a platypus exhaust port. There was outrigger wheels along the center line of the vehicle. But what's really interesting, Dee, is craft used Venetian blind wings that had Inconel exhaust plates. And these plates, these Venetian blind plates, could be vectored from 0 to 45 degrees angle of attack, and they were mated from the front to the back, forming one complete wing section. So what you do is, when you are getting ready for a vertical takeoff, you would vector these vanes so that it would form one complete wing section. Once you've taken off and you have transferred into sort of a horizontal flight mode, you could alter the angle of attack of these Venetian blind wings, allowing for conventional flight. It also had a 20-millimeter Gatling gun up front. It was a tank buster aircraft. It's believed that this was a strictly a one-off. Now, that was one of the aircraft that was at this display, Dee.
I have to tell you, I've seen a lot of military aircraft in my time, but this one is, to me, rather bizarre looking.
It's very bizarre. It's very bizarre. It operates on the principle of the Coanda effect. This was discovered so long ago, but it's such a simple process by Mr. Henry Coanda. Basically, he found out that if you took jet exhaust and you blow it over the top surface of the wing, you can cause a very significant lifting force. You don't need to blow it on the bottom. You blow it over the top of the wing, it will follow, it will adhere to the curvature of the airfoil wing section, and you can actually create a lifting force with no forward movement. And that was the whole concept behind that aircraft. One other quick aircraft that I should highlight, too, is what we have termed the Pulsar. Now, this aircraft was highlighted Aviation Week Space Technology. It has been completely vetted. It has been basically independently verified. We know this was a real aircraft. What this thing looked like, it was approximately 100 feet in length, 65 feet wide. It looked like a flattened football diamond-shaped craft. The exterior of the vehicle was completely composed of thermal-resistant heat-ablative tiles taken directly off the space shuttle. The reference for this is Aviation Week Space Technology, December 24, 1990. This was an unmanned craft. There were two air intakes on either side of the center line of the vehicle, completely unmanned, tricycle landing gear. There were control surfaces along the leading and trailing edge of the vehicle. There were 121 tubes at the bottom of this vehicle, and the craft had four turbojet engines buried inside the fuselage. The concept being, D, on this, is once this craft got going up to about Mach 3, the entire leading edge started glowing red hot. At that time, you could shut down the conventional engines, and then you could start by way of a whole series of fuel injector nozzles. You start introducing a modified liquid methane fuel with a boron-based additive directly into the superheated shockwave. As soon as that happens, it immediately expands, combusts, and compresses between the superheated shockwave and the tapered afterbody of this aircraft, pushing it across the sky at about 12,000 miles an hour.
Wow.
That was also at this display. Now, on the bottom of the vehicle, there were 121 launch tubes, each containing a 1/10 megaton warhead that could be launched in a 1/10 of a second. And it's believed that 18 of these aircraft were built during the Reagan administration. So if you take 121 times 18, you can think about the power projection that Reagan had during his administration, which is one reason the untold story of the Cold War is that when some of the Russian generals and Air Force personnel from the former Soviet Union, when they saw a sneak peek inside of this hangar and saw what the American defense industry, the aerospace industry, we're talking about Lockheed Martin Skunk Works, Rockwell International, General Dynamics, General Electric, McDonnell Douglas, which is Boeing now, when they saw what we had in this hangar, they threw up their hands and said, you know what, we're done. Because in order for us to retrofit our radar ranges, it would be at the cost of trillions of rubles, and we can't afford it, and that's how we won the Cold War, basically. Okay, now we need to move on quickly to the other very significant aircraft that was also a part of this display. Now, we believe that this section of the display may have taken place at the Lockheed L-1011 hangar in Palmdale, California, Air Force Plant 42. That may be where the second part took place. But the point is, there was something else going on at this exhibit. There were three flying saucers a part of this exhibit. They all looked the same. They were 24. The next one was 60 feet in diameter. The final one was 130 feet in diameter. So you can imagine just how massive that large one was. I mean, just very, very big aircraft. Now, the top of the vehicle, the top of the craft, had six CCD cameras and one on top for a total of seven. It was said that these were ripped off from the Vegas casinos. It's the exact same system. They could all be slewed in conjunction and produce an artificial image on the inside of the pilot's visor via the Apache heads-up display, basically. It's an artificial system. There's no windows in this craft. Down the central column on the upper portion of this vehicle, there were four ejection seats taken directly off the F-4 Phantom. This vehicle used off-the-shelf components which were already available within the aerospace industry. That was stressed by people who saw this vehicle there. Now, going further down the column to the primary section of this craft, there was, we believe, to be some type of nuclear containment device. Along the midsection of this craft, there was a 12-foot diameter Tesla coil. Back down to the lower section, there were at least 24 oxygen cylinders that were radially located along the lower circumference of the craft. You can see the picture there that shows you what this thing looked like, the illustration. There was an articulating arm there also, so you can think that they're probably going somewhere. The outer portion of the vehicle was composed of fiberglass composite panels that were fastened with Zeus fasteners. Now, any pilots out there know what a Zeus fastener is. This is a quarter-turn, simple fastener that allows you to fasten a engine cowling onto your engine area compartment. So this is a very simple way to do it. Now, the people who have relayed information regarding this display said that when they saw these three flying saucers in this hangar, it looked like these things had been around for decades. There were fingerprints on these things. They had paint chips on them. They were slightly beat up. The point is, they had been around for quite some time. Directly below the lower section of this craft, there were multiple, this is the capacitor section with plates. The plates were stacked positive, negative, with the positive always being on top. So very briefly, how this thing flew, it did not fly by the way of aerodynamics that we know them, but there was a very high voltage electrical charge fed into the 12-foot diameter Tesla coil. Once that happens, there's a magnetic field that forms above this craft in the form of a toroid donut, and by way of a rheostat device that was mounted on one of those F4 ejection seats, the pilot had the capability of overlaying those field lines directly onto those capacitor plates, causing pitch, yaw, and roll. And per the MC who was directing this exhibit, he stated that we had super luminal technology and capability with these vehicles.
Oh, wow, you've got me speechless on this one. I've never heard of
this
craft.
So that is the level of technology that we had at this time, okay? And if you go back to the Condon report and you look at some of the photos there, specifically what was photographed by Harvey Williams, we're talking 1960s here. This thing was already flying for decades before this exhibit ever took place. This is consistent with what Ben Rich talked about. Before Ben passed away, Ben Rich is the former head of Lockheed Skunk Works. He made some bombshell comments, some absolutely bombshell comments. He was in the hospital. He called Jim Goodall called him and wanted to request a non-holds-barred interview with Ben Rich, who agreed to this Unfortunately, Ben passed away, so they never got to do it. However, Jim Goodall, who is an aviation writer and enthusiast, he did get Ben on the phone one last time, and Ben told Jim Goodall, this is a quote, he said, "Jim, we have things flying that are 50 years beyond what you could possibly even dream of. If you've seen it on Star Trek, Star Wars, we've been there, done that, or decided it wasn't worth the effort," unquote, coming directly from Ben Rich. So here we have the president, the former head of Skunk Works, saying that we have things flying that are 50 years beyond what you could possibly even dream of.
In other words, we could take E.T. home.
That's exactly correct. Now, he said that twice. I put together, we don't have time to go into all these, but I put together a large dossier of every one of Ben Rich's quotes. Every one of them is bombshell. It is associated with advanced propulsion and space travel. He did say that. He said, "The Air Force has just given us a contract to take E.T. back home." This is 1993, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base slide presentation. He also said the same thing at his 1993 UCLA Alumni Club speech, so we have independent verification that he did, in point of fact, say that.
Hmm.
Absolutely.
Let's see, we've got about 12 minutes before we go to break. Should we move on to the,
We are going to move on to the Brilliant Buzzard. The Brilliant Buzzard is a two-stage to orbit space plane that was procured after the Challenger explosion on January 28, 1986. It also has the sub-code name of the Copper Coast Copper Canyon program, may also be associated with the Black Star program that was highlighted in the March 6, 2006 Aviation Week Space Technology article. Now, I've spoken to two eyewitnesses who have seen this aircraft fly directly over their heads. It was making an emergency landing at Edwards North Base Complex. We should state very briefly that when you talk about classified aircraft and you talk about Edwards Air Force Base, it's important to keep in mind that the classified research at that facility takes place at the North Base Complex. It's almost as though there's two separate bases there. So it's the North Base Complex that we're interested in for this particular discussion. Now, the eyewitnesses who saw this vehicle, which are reported in that AvWeek article that I just mentioned, and the two that I spoke to, basically said that this thing was absolutely, it was just absolutely massive. It was 276 feet long. It had a crew of three. Of course, the pilot sat up front. There was a co-pilot who sat in back of him. He was also a navigator. There was a radar control officer who served as the liaison between the mothership and the parasitic aircraft. It was 120 feet in length. It flew at Mach 5, 3,300 miles an hour. It stood 10 to 12 feet off the ground. What's interesting, Dee, is eyewitnesses who reported seeing this said that the diagonally cut 45-degree angle exhaust import, the air intakes on this vehicle, which hang 7 feet down from the bottom surface of the craft, they said, the witnesses reported that you could drive a Volkswagen Beetle inside the air intakes of this craft. That's how big this vehicle is.
Any idea on the ceiling on this aircraft?
It'll go up to 800,000 feet. The smaller aircraft, which is the parasitic aircraft, the main aircraft uses the combined cycle turbo ramjet engines, and it'll go up to 120,000 feet and beyond. But the small parasitic aircraft that it launches, because this is the mothership, that is 90 feet in length, and it uses two scramjets, or supersonic combustion ramjets, using a modified liquid methane fuel with a boron-based additive. It also has the capability of launching two 1,000-pound payloads into a low-Earth orbit. And so that was seen by multiple eyewitnesses, you know, right around the 1989 time frame, somewhere right in there. this bird definitely exists. Multiple eyewitnesses have seen this.
Well,
absolutely.
To me, it looks like a combination of SR-71 Blackbird and a Concorde.
It absolutely does. Now, here's an interesting story. I spoke to an aviation photographer who knew the sheriff of Nye County back in 1994. His name was Bert Gray. The sheriff of Nye County, his name was Bert Gray, and he told me that in 1994 there was an altercation at the base. I'm talking about the remote test site in Nevada, also known as Air Force Flight Test Center Detachment 3, and there was a murder that took place at Area 51, and the sheriff was called on the base, and there was a military police who met him there. They put him in a Jeep, and they started going down the tarmac area. One of the hangar doors was open, and he got a view inside the hangar as they were driving along, and it looked like a black-colored Concorde, he said. This sheriff talked, you know, very briefly to the driver and said, is this the Aurora that everyone's been talking about? It's not called Aurora, but he just made that mention really quick, and the MP turned to him and said, I can't tell you that. And that was the end of that. So that was just another tidbit story to add to this whole thing about there being some type of aircraft that has replaced the Blackbird. We cannot rely solely on satellites from the National Reconnaissance Office. We need to have this rapid response worldwide capability to stretch our reconnaissance eyes across the entire world.
This craft is just amazing. I mean, Mach 5, that's...
Yep, that's around 3,300 miles an hour. Very, very large craft, a mothership. Looked like the old 1960s XB-70. Now, what's interesting to note here is there are probably, and I feel confident in at least mentioning, there are at least two versions of this aircraft. How can I say this, and what proof do we have? Well, if you look at Aviation Week Space Technology, November 11th, 1991, just the first two lines here, it says, two unusually loud sonic booms heard along the west coast from San Diego to north of Los Angeles, California, may have been produced by high-flying classified aircraft returning to test ranges in Nevada. Okay? The article goes on and states that 220 of Caltech's seismological instruments were triggered when this thing flew over. So, keeping in mind the date of November 11th, 1991, okay, at 6:30 a.m., October 31st. So what I did is I contacted Caltech, and I told them who I was, what I was doing, and I asked them very politely, I said, would you please check your records, your seismological records, for any type of very unusual seismic activity on that day of the month, on that day of the week, and at that specific time. And I knew that these things were called airquakes. They're not called earthquakes, they're called airquakes. So what they did, about a week later, they sent me the data back for that date, and I actually am looking at a printout right now, and I'm going to post this on my Facebook site where you can see pictures of most of these vehicles and illustrations and everything. But we have it right here. They're calling it a sonic event, and there is a massive sonic boom footprint on that day at that time. So in my professional assessment, this is the most conclusive proof that we have to date of a so-called hypersonic Mach 5 aircraft within the military inventory. We actually have a piece of evidence to support the claim.
You know, that reminds me of when everybody was hearing all these strange sonic booms on along the eastern seaboard, late, so I'd say 78, 79 up into 80. And then later on we found out it was from the Blackbird.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, this was going on for months at a time. There were at least 10 to 12 of these airquakes. I mean, this was not an isolated incident. They did this, like, on Thursday nights at 5:30 in the morning for weeks this went on. You don't get that kind of earthquake redundancy and repeatability. So clearly they were flying something over. This thing came over from the ocean, flew over Catalina Island, over Los Angeles, and then headed straight into Area 51, basically. So you can see the footprint of how this thing was tracking for a landing, coming back from a mission.
We have, about 3 minutes before we go to break.
Sure.
So could we move on to the last one?
Yes, let's do that. The last one is the Manta Ray. It's been known to be called the TR-3A Black Manta, but that is not the actual designation. It's believed that it's actually called the Manta Ray. This flew along with F-117s during Desert Storm. The reference for that, Aviation Week Space Technology, March 9th, 1992. It says, quote, possible black aircraft seen flying in formation with F-117s and KC-135. So the bottom line is here that this was a Northrop aircraft. It was carrier-based. It could be based at Tonopah Test Range. We believe that the prime contractor was Northrop. McDonnell Douglas, Teledyne Ryan may have been supported as subcontractors. First flight was 1981 at the remote test site in Nevada, also known as Area 51. It later flew out of Tonopah Test Range. It moved to Holloman Air Force Base with the F-117s. It has a wingspan of 63 feet, 42 feet wide, 42 feet in length. It uses two General Electric F-404 engines. It has a 3,500-mile range. And what's interesting here is that it's been said that for every three F-117As, there is one Manta Ray. So if you do the math, there are 59 F-117s, so there are approximately 19 of the Manta Rays. These were gray in color, dark in color, single pilot, an air intake on both sides of the center line, with two inward-canted vertical stabilizers. This aircraft flew with the F-117s back in Desert Storm and remains classified D to this day. They will not release this aircraft.
It's an interesting-looking configuration on this thing. Those intakes are huge.
Yes. Yep, they're big. And it is orders of magnitude more stealthy than the F-117, because you will recall that when Ben Rich procured the development of the F-117 with the HAVBLUE program, they used multiple faceted plates. But when Northrop came out with the B-2, November 22, 1988, they had completely done away with faceted flat plates and went on to smooth contouring, which you see in the B-2. That's exactly what we see in the Manta Ray being used, the same type technology. So they are orders of magnitude more stealthy than the F-117.
I'm amazed at these craft. And unfortunately, we now need to go to a break. So we'll be back with more of Michael's research on next hour of UFO reports. And so stay tuned, and we'll be back in 9 to 10 minutes here on Eye to the Sky, the UFO synopsis on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome to Eye to the Sky, the UFO synopsis. Now here's your host, Dee Andrew.
And welcome back to Eye to the Sky, the UFO synopsis, here on UFO Paranormal Radio Network, also broadcast on UPRN 105.5 New Orleans. I'm your host, DeAndrew, and tonight we've been talking with Michael Stratt. Michael, we were talking during the break and decided that on the UFO end of it, that
right.
we would start with case number 4, which is
yes.
the fourth picture on the UFO link on the website,
yes.
the sky, that's EYE, the number 2, thesky.net, if you want to follow along with us. And this picture, I have to say, is awesome, and so is the story behind it.
It is a fascinating story, Dee. Yes, so let's definitely go to UFO case number 4. Let me try to give you the best breakdown I can on this case. Now, this comes from Mark McCandlish, who is, in my opinion, the world's premier aerospace conceptual artist. He has worked for Boeing, Lockheed, General Dynamics, most of the major prime contractors, aerospace industry. So when they're looking for a new aircraft that they have in mind, they come to Mark to do the illustration of the craft. He's done magazine covers around the world, Popular Mechanics, Popular Science. He's known all around the world as the best of the best. And as this story went on here, he was at a Warbird type air show where there was a B-24 Liberator there. And he was speaking to the pilot who flew that aircraft in World War II, and they struck up a conversation. The conversation continued smoothly down this road here, and the subject of UFOs kind of came up near the end here. And Mark asked him, well, you know, what did you see? And he said, well, later on in my career, specifically in 1966 over South Vietnam, I was flying a B-52. This is what he was telling Mark. And so this was a nighttime mission over South Vietnam, 1966. The moon was out, so there was some residual backlighting on this particular sighting. And they were flying across very smoothly, smooth air, clear, and they were absolutely shocked to see a gigantic flying saucer, which was estimated to be a quarter mile in diameter. Now, I did some comparisons on Mark's original sketch, and I did some triangulations, and I think Mark is actually being conservative. This craft is a lot closer to a half mile in diameter, if you actually do the mathematics and the numbers. So let's just say for the purposes of this discussion, it was between at least a quarter mile to a half mile in diameter. Now, this thing, it looked like your classic flying saucer. There was a series of rotor blades that were rotating along the outer circumference of this vehicle. It also had a domed cupola on top, which had 28 levels. Now, how do we know that it was 280 feet tall? Because they actually counted the different levels on the dome of this. So we know that the top was just 280 feet right there. Now, the B-52 flew around this thing 3 times. They got a real good look at this thing. They flew under it. They flew around it. They noticed that when they did count the upper levels of the dome, there were beings, D, looking back at them. That's how close they were. They could actually see beings looking back at them through the transparent windows in the dome of this craft. Now, what's interesting, D, is when this craft departed, it didn't just fly away like some cases, but what happened is, in point of fact, that when this large, gigantic flying saucer departed, what it did is it opened up some type of wormhole or something so that when this craft went inside this tubular-shaped cylindrical wormhole, what it did is it ripped open something, and blue sky, shiny daylight, white puffy clouds were seen as this thing was being sucked into this wormhole, and then after a few seconds, it like trickled back to darkness again. So it had opened up some type of space-time continuum, or it had gone to the other side of the planet where it was light there, and that was being drawn into this via an intense gravitational field. We're not clear exactly how that happened, but that is what was reported by the B-52 crew members. And when they landed, they were debriefed by FBI agents. So we now have this case on file, D.
the FBI debriefed Air Force?
The FBI debriefed the crew members of the B-52 when they landed. So somewhere out there, there's a B-52 case of this thing interacting with a gigantic quarter-mile to half-mile diameter flying saucer, and it's in an FBI file somewhere. It has been documented. This case has been documented. And so my attempt to redraw this case is what you see in UFO case number 4. This B-52 is flying around this thing. They got a good look at it, and it's now a part of the historical record.
I find that fascinating that the FBI would be doing the debriefing and not the Air Force.
I know. It's interesting.
Blue Book wasn't shut down yet.
Yeah, that's true. Blue Book shut down in 1969, so this was still an active thing. Now, there's no indication that this case was sent to the Blue Book file because no one's ever reported that being in those files at College Park, Maryland. But this is a real case. This actually took place. It's not the only one either. There are other cases similar to this of these gigantic, perhaps this was a mothership-type vehicle. We sort of spoke about that during the 1986 encounter over Alaska, where three large flying saucers, at least one of them was between a quarter to a half mile in diameter. So we have a consistency there of the same type vehicle.
Wow.
That's the Japanese airline case. So is going on. It's more than just one, absolutely. But, yeah, this is a fantastic case, regardless.
Well, and the British airline pilot that reported the huge cylindrical craft off of, I forget which channel island it is in the English Channel, here just, a year or two ago?
That's correct, yes, yes. That's another case. That's a very well-documented case. I believe that gentleman 100%.
Well, and then another aircraft corroborated it.
Independent verification, yes.
Definitely.
Absolutely. What's interesting, it's funny you mention that, because if you will recall, in that Japanese airline case, they had onboard radar in the form of the TCAS, that's the Traffic Collision Avoidance System. They had independent radar lock by Anchorage ATC, and they also had radar lock by the Anchorage Air Force Base. So we had three independent verifications, radar and visual. There was no way that was any hallucination. That was a real event. That thing made news around the world. The pilot was relieved from his duty. He was later reinstated, but that was a dead solid UFO case. Made news all around the world. I mean, it doesn't get much better than that.
If you don't mind skipping cases,
yes,
again, I'd like to go to case number 2.
Okay. Case number 2. I got this from the Center for UFO Studies in Chicago. This is a very well-documented case. There are more than one of these type cases with craft that look identical to this. I took the original sketch from QFOS, I redrew that in AutoCAD, created a technical line drawing, and then from the line drawing I made this 3D rendering here. Now, what happened here is two gentlemen were returning from work, they were driving down the road, and off to their right, their peripheral vision, they caught a flash of light. The next thing they knew, there was this very interesting flying saucer that had kind of a, you would call it a somewhat semi-gunmetal polished aluminum exterior. There was a bubble transparency canopy on top. And what's interesting, Dee, is this thing was sort of like magnetically locked to the hood of this vehicle and just above and forward of the hood of the car. So you can kind of get a mental picture of where this thing was placed. Eventually, they stopped. The bubble canopy opened up, and one of the two beings that was inside this craft, he flew out of the flying saucer. He had a backpack on his back. He flew out to the driver's side door, opened up the door, and remember, this being was about 3 feet tall, so he was pretty small, but what's interesting, Dee, is he had very unusual facial features in the form of hamburger meat. That's what this being looked like. His skin was very rough, only 3 feet tall. He got into between the steering wheel and the driver's side position, and he proceeded to drive this car an additional 70 feet off the road onto a dirt road area there. In the case, there's no mention as to how he reached the foot pedals of the vehicle, but that's what the case stated. Now, you can imagine the two people in this car, they were shocked. They were horrified. One of them went so far as to jump out of the car, and he ran to a next-door neighbor's house and reported this case. The other gentleman, he stayed in the vehicle, and this being tried to contact or make communication with this gentleman by way of these high-frequency, almost birdcage noises, very high-frequency noises, no communication that could actually be understood. And then the authorities came back to see the gentleman who was in the car. He was in a complete state of daze, and then that being took off and the craft disappeared. So in a nutshell, that's what happened in this case. But it is a multiple occupancy described case that has happened more than once. But what's interesting, Dee, is along the circumference of the vehicle, there were multiple colored lights that were rotating along the circumference, but then there was a very interesting, you can't call it a flame, but there was a flickering light that came down from the bottom hole of this craft, and it stopped at a certain point. So I'm asking the question, who had the technology back in 1967, specifically November 2nd, 1967, to produce a craft that could hover, A, B, it had the capability of doing this lightsaber maneuver with the lights below it. How do you get light to stop at a specific length from the origin point? If you have a laser, it's going to hit the nearest wall, but that's not what this light on this craft did. It was suspended under the vehicle for about 6 feet and stopped in midair. It did not hit the ground. So this is a very interesting technology. So, Dee, this is just a brief thumbnail sketch of this particular sighting.
Well, you hear a lot of cases anymore of tourniqueted light beams coming out of
yes.
craft.
Yes.
Now, this happened in well, I should say near Rary, Idaho. Am I saying
yes.
that correctly?
Yes. Rary, Idaho UFO sighting, November the 2nd, 1967. Well-documented QFOS case with a QFOS file number to go with it. So it's documented. It is there. It is absolutely, it is part of the historical record, absolutely. MUFON has the case as well. It's been very well reported.
Okay, I picked the first two. How about you pick the next one?
Okay, let's move on to UFO case number one, which I really like this case. This case has got to be one of the most significant in all ufology, in my opinion anyway. Just very, very interesting case. This took place over Brazil on October the 5th, 1996, and what you'll see if you look at UFO case number one for anyone seeing this here on the website, is a pilot was flying the equivalent of a United States Cherokee aircraft. He was flying an Embraer single-engine low-wing aircraft, private pilot, flying at about 5,000 feet just 15 minutes after he departed. His name is Geraldo Westendorf. He was 39 years old at the time. This is October 5th, 1996. And he was shocked to see a gigantic faceted volcano cone-shaped craft hovering in midair not too far from where he was flying. Now, he said that this thing was 325 feet in diameter and 225 feet tall. That's what this thing looked like. It sort of looked like a construction cone or a volcano, but he said that on each flat faceted face of this cone or volcano, there was a bulge, kind of a rectangular or triangular-shaped bulge on each of the flat plates of this craft. So what he did is he started circling this thing to get a clearer view of it. In the report, It states that his left wingtip got within 40 yards of the craft. So you can see, you can imagine just how close he was. Now, the next thing that happened is, as he made his third orbit around the vehicle, he noticed that the top of this thing, which originally had sort of a rounded point on top, it retracted down, which exposing a hole. And out from this hole came a classic flying saucer. It looked like just any of the science fiction saucers that you would see within Hollywood. It came out vertically, as you can see in the illustration there, and then this thing rotated 90 degrees in the horizontal, and then he said it, quote, took off at Mach 10, just like a spark off a grinding wheel, just like that. Very, very fast. Now, if you would see this thing in the air, I mean, this would be absolutely amazing. Now, ground... the airport did report seeing this on their radar, so there is independent verification there. But what's interesting, D, is when he saw that happen to this flying saucer that came out of the top of this vehicle, he decided to climb higher in altitude. So he pulled away from the craft, started trying to climb altitude so that he could look inside the hole of this thing. He didn't say he would want to fly over it and look down, but he wanted to get kind of a peripheral vision into this hole. And just as he was climbing in altitude, he noticed that this whole cone-shaped volcano UFO started rotating much faster than it was previously. And he said that these red beams of light started shooting from the hole of this craft, just hundreds of these very intensity, high-intensity red light beams. And the next thing that happened is this thing just shot off immediately. And for him being in such a close vicinity to this craft, he was absolutely sure that there would be some type of transonic shockwave that took place because of the speed of this thing. He was horrified that he was going to get hit by the shockwave. That shockwave never came, and he landed safely. So however this thing was able to do that without breaking the sound barrier and creating a shockwave was never explained. But again, Dee, this is now part of the historical record.
Wow, that's awesome.
I mean, this has got to be one of the weirdest cases in ufology. Absolutely. Absolutely.
I've never heard of any craft being described as volcano-shaped.
Yep. It was a faceted volcano, according to his description. Just a very unusual craft. Totally unusual. Unlike anything ever reported, yes.
On to the next?
On to the next one. UFO case number 3. This was seen by a single eyewitness. A lady was preparing her 9-acre ranch for some additional work later in the evening. She noticed a bright light descend through the cloud bank. It got within about an eighth of a mile, and then a little bit closer after that. But she noticed two high-intensity green beams shooting down, hitting the ground in the proximity of this vehicle. But she also noticed, and if you look at the picture, you'll see that there are two series of holes emanating from the outer circumference of this vehicle. Now, these holes had flames shooting out that were counter-rotating. So this had a counter-rotating effect. The very top of this craft had a rectangular-shaped transparent dome on top that had two beings that were looking at each other. They were facing each other inside this particular dome-shaped transparent canopy. Now, what's interesting here is as soon as this thing got within about 200 feet from her position, it stopped rotating. One of the beings, who he got out of his seat, the other being stayed in his seat. When he got out, he stood up and he moved his arms and his hands near the edge of the transparent canopy. He looked over and down like he was looking at something. It was never explained exactly what he was looking at, but he was looking at something. He got back into his seat. Then the vehicle started rotating in just like it had did before. And then this thing took off at a high rate of speed. But what's interesting, Dee, is the report on this case indicated that the two beings who were associated with the sighting, they had these opaque helmets that came all the way down to their shoulders, and they were wearing one-piece flight suits, which were tight-fitting. And that's consistent with a few other cases that we've seen where these crew members were wearing these very unusual helmets that came all the way down to their shoulders. This is just another really interesting case, Dee.
And looking at this illustration, it wasn't that far, above the water.
In this case, it was actually over land, and I have it just entering the land area here. So this is kind of like as it was coming down, and then it was approaching the land. That's how I've depicted it here. But as far as the upper transparent canopy, that part was not rotating like the other two were. The two sections that were below this, they had the counter rotating, but of course the crew compartment was not rotating. There was a bright light in the center of the vehicle where the two occupants were looking at it as they were facing each other. So what I think is interesting is what are beings who perhaps are coming from another planet, what are they doing using counter-rotating flames as being associated with the propulsion system? I just think that's an interesting question that should be further explored. But this is a very good case. This is definitely a historical case. It's part of the record.
And then looking at all the, portholes, for lack of a better term,
right,
around this thing, that's a lot of flame.
That's a lot. I mean, something, there was perhaps some type of gyroscopic stabilization going on or something. The green lights were associated with this sighting. It was 25 feet in diameter, 8 feet high, according to the case report. And again, these beings, they were facing each other with these helmets that came down to their shoulders. So I looked around, and Earth versus the Flying Saucers, that old B movie in science fiction Hollywood, they have the identical helmets as what was reported in this case. So the question is, who knew what and when? And also, if you look at Star Wars, when they're getting ready to destroy Princess Leia's home planet, the military officers who are preparing the beam from the Death Star, they are wearing a very similar helmet arrangement. So again, is Hollywood a belated designer leak for something else? Are they telling us something through the movies? I think in many cases we can say yes.
I agree with you on that wholeheartedly.
Yeah, definitely. Well, yeah, I mean, there's more to Hollywood than meets the eye. I really do think that they are telling us something here. They're definitely trying to relay a story in the best way they can. It may be associated with the quote unquote acclimation process that we've heard about for years.
Definitely, definitely. I do believe there is something behind that idea. The next case, case
okay,
five.
Okay, let's go to UFO case five. I actually spoke to this gentleman. He is a retired McDonnell Douglas aerospace engineer. He is absolutely credible. It is part of the MUFON case, so this is documented. There's a case file number to go with it. I have his original sketch. We have his original description, three-page typed-up description of the vehicle, and his handwritten notes. So, again, this is a very solid case. MUFON case file number to go with it. It's actually 1961001. It's the case file number. So I called this gentleman, and I asked him for specific details regarding the case. He was very helpful, very honest. I believed his story 100%. He said that he was in college in Bloomington, Illinois. This is summer 1961, and he and his friend were going out to the library. They departed their dorm rooms at the same time, he said. And when they looked up, they saw this very interesting flying saucer. He said it was 45 feet in diameter. It was 25 feet high. There were small portholes along the circumference of the craft. He said the windows were not circular. This is interesting, I thought. He said they weren't circular. They were elliptical in shape. There was a small bulb or dome on the bottom of this vehicle, too. there was a woman who was on the porch of her house. She saw it too. So we have three eyewitnesses who've seen this. That's very important. Multiple eyewitnesses is always a good thing. This thing flew over the cornfield and then departed from the horizon at a slow rate of speed. So again, we have his case on file. Got the original AutoCAD drawn from the original sketch, and from that, that's how I created the 3D rendering. So this is now a part of the historical record.
The setting reminds me a lot of the Rex Heflin photograph.
I think I know the one you're talking about.
Looked a lot like a hat.
Yes. Yes. There was a slight angle. Yes, there was a slight angle of about 15 degrees from the vertical. The sides of the sloping upper dome came in from the vertical, and again, it had the, he said there were no beings associated, but it did have elliptical windows, which I thought was interesting, Dee.
We have a question from our virtual auditorium.
Okay.
From Dimensional Star, and she would like to know if you had any cases from Oregon.
From Oregon. I would have to check my file. I may, but I just don't know offhand if I do. These are from all around the world. I've got cases from all around the world. The presentation that I gave at the recent UFO Crash Retrieval Conference was titled Bombshell UFO Case Files Revealed, Excerpts from the QFOS Archives. And so those cases were pulled from those original files, and they are worldwide. They are global. They have files from Japan, Canada, the United States, Mexico, Russia, Asia, all over the world. So I'm sure that there's an Oregon case in there somewhere.
Well, there's your answer, Dimensional. this last image is interesting.
Yes.
Number six, with the gaping hole in it.
I know. I thought this was a very interesting case, too. This is also a part of the record, too. Now, the story here is this took place in South Africa, March 30th, 1995. Now, I went through this case a number of times so that I could hit all the details. And how this happened is a gentleman was driving down this curvy road, and you can see in this image here, in this illustration, this type of S-curve road, and when he passed through one of these curves, he noticed a gentleman, which I do not have shown here in this image, but there was a gentleman who was on his left side who was shielding his eyes from something, like he was trying to protect himself from something. And the next thing that this driver saw right in front of him was this very interesting, classic flying saucer-type vehicle. He said it had three tripod legs. There was a dome on top, which was not transparent. There was no beings associated with this craft whatsoever. So there was nothing as far as that's concerned. But he noticed, too, that there were slots or portholes located on the lower section of the dome, but then on the port side of this vehicle, as he was looking at it where he stopped his vehicle, there was some type of hull breach on the port side of this vehicle, exposing slight portions of the interior of the craft. Now, he got out of his vehicle and started trying to walk around his car door when he was frozen in some type of lock or something. He could not move at all for about 2 minutes. After that two-minute time period, this flying saucer departed from the road at a slow rate of speed, and then that lock was shut off. He could not move his muscles, which he said they were sore after this happened. And then when he tried to find the gentleman who was shielding his eyes from this craft, all he saw was that gentleman pedaling his bicycle down a dirt road, and that's the entire case for this file, Dee. That's what happened here. So something was happening, some type of malfunction, some type of damage occurred. It's not even really stated that repairs were made. It was almost like this thing made an emergency landing. They tried to do something. Perhaps they thought they were being watched or seen by eyewitnesses, and then this thing took off. So, very unusual case of a flying saucer, which was seen landed on a road with a hull breach on the port side, and then it exited the area.
Wow, I've never heard of that case.
Yeah, very unusual case.
But like I said, you've come with some that I've never heard of before. Quite a few, actually, that I had never heard of before.
I hadn't heard about these cases either until I started digging into these QFOS files.
One image that we didn't get to on the secret military aircraft page was the one on the bottom that has a cutaway on it. And I thought it would be kind of interesting to check that one out and see how theirs ties in with ours.
Yeah, that is the alien reproduction vehicle. That's the one that was at Norton Air Force Base on November 12th, 1988. That is the one that we certainly covered, that particular vehicle.
Okay, I understand now.
Yes, that's at Norton Air Force Base. That was the one that was with the Superstall and the Pulsar at that covert dog and pony show exhibit. Absolutely.
It's definitely not a conventional craft, is it?
No, it's not a conventional craft. But they termed it the alien reproduction vehicle. It was made of off-the-shelf components within the aerospace industry. There are reports, and this comes from Bill Scott, Aviation Week, and he will back me up on this. He's gone on record. He knew a gentleman who happened to be his ground crew operator back in 1973 when he was flying F-16s out of Edwards, where this gentleman, to make a long story short, was basically going across the dry lake bed near Edwards North Base Complex, looked into one of the hangars, and to his surprise, he saw the same exact flying saucer that was hovering off the floor. There were no strings, there were no cables, there was no supporting structure underneath. The next thing he knew, there was a rifle barrel aimed at his head. And for the next, I think it was 3 days, he was debriefed about something that he had never seen. So that was another case from a very reliable witness. So we've got at least two independent sources who have confirmed that such a vehicle exists. We have the Harvey Williams 1960s report that was highlighted in the Condon report, which shows almost the identical shaped craft, D. So at the very least, by 1960, we had these vehicles with exoatmospheric capabilities within the aerospace industry flying at that time. Now, I'm asking the question, if you extrapolate what this means, and if you take this thing as far as it can go, we know that Neil Armstrong and Buzz landed at Tranquility Base on July 20th, 1969, but yet these craft were flying 9 years earlier. Is this perhaps one reason why Neil Armstrong doesn't talk about Apollo 11? Is it possible, perhaps, that he knows he wasn't the first one there? I just throw that out there.
Good question.
I just throw that out there. And I'm not making this up, because let me reference my source here. July 1957, Mechanics Illustrated Magazine. Very interesting article. Don't have time to go into all of it here, but let me just read you very quickly this quote. It says, quote, "At least 14 United States universities and other research centers are hard at work cracking the gravity barrier. Convair on the West Coast, Glenn L. Martin Aircraft Company of Baltimore, Maryland, Bell Aircraft Company of Buffalo, New York, and Sperry Gyroscope Company of Great Neck, New York, maintain teams of researchers and engineers prying into nature's most jealously guarded secret, gravity." So, Dee, there you go. By 1957, we already had think tanks, universities, aerospace prime contractors working on anti-gravity propulsion systems by 1957. So now you hook that up with what we talked about earlier, with the multiple billions of dollars in black budget funding being filtered into these programs. It's anyone's guess what we had flying at that time, and it's a dream world what we have flying now. Absolutely.
It makes you wonder even more and more about reverse engineering from
Maxwell. Absolutely.
Which would bring us to Bob Lazar in Roswell.
Which does bring us to Bob Lazar. That's a really good tie-in here. We can do that very quickly. Now, I'm sure everyone here is basically familiar with the Lazar story, but really quickly here, he was, according to him, he was hired as a propulsion systems engineer, physicist between December 1988 and April 1989. This was at the Area S4, which is 15 miles south of Area 51. He was given his initial interview at the EG&G Special Projects building at McCarran International Airport. Once he passed that, and which I thought, D, was very interesting, during this hour-and-a-half interview, they didn't ask him technical questions as you would think. I mean, certainly there were questions of a technical nature, but then they started asking him questions like, how would you handle a stressful situation where you're pressured for time? Would you handle that stressful situation by throwing shop tools on the floor, including screwdrivers? I mean, does that strike you as very odd, Dee? I mean,
very.
To me, that actually lends credibility to this account, because this is so bizarre. What a very unusual question to ask. Now, EG&G, which has been bought and consolidated by another company, but back in 1988, they were still the direct outfit that ran the day-to-day operations at the remote test site. Wackenhut provides the security. The airspace over Dreamland is designated R-4808 space N. That's Dreamland Aerospace airspace. Now, if you're not authorized to be in that airspace, you will be neutralized. We'll just leave it at that. The security badge that Bob was provided with stated that he was employed by the U.S. Department of Naval Intelligence. So again, what do we know about who is running these programs? Perhaps we've thought for so long that the U.S. Air Force is in charge of these programs, but in point of fact, is the U.S. Department of Naval Intelligence which is running these programs, or at least some of them, and that's consistent with what Dr. Greer talked about, where he said that high-level Jesuit priests are on our nuclear-powered Trident submarines tracking objects going over 300 to 400 knots below the surface, and this is being tracked by our submarines. So again, the Navy, in one way or the other, is definitely involved with this. He said that when he was called to work, they called him at odd hours. He was to report at McCarran International Airport. He was flown via Janet Airlines, which is at EG&G Terminal at McCarran. Once they got to Area 51, they boarded a bus that drove them to Area S4. That's where the 9 hangar bays were. That's where he saw 9 of the aircraft. One, he termed the sport model, was 52 feet in diameter. It was 16 feet high. It had three different layers or sections to the craft. The upper deck composed of three very small seats that were too small for human pilots to fly in. There were three gravity amplifier heads. Those gravity amplifier heads led directly into three gravity amplifiers. In the center of the vehicle, there was an antimatter reactor with a waveguide extending from the central part of the craft. Now, what do we know about how can we prove this, and is there any independent verification? So, Dee, I want to go out on a limb here, and I want to talk about something that really hasn't been talked about before. So let me just throw this at everyone, see if everyone can follow with what I'm saying here that might back up Bob's claim here and get some independent verification. Now, if you learn nothing from this conversation this evening and everyone listening, if you take away nothing at all from this conversation, take away this point, and I want to repeat it twice. It goes like this. The color blue is equal to extraterrestrial intelligence and UFO technology. So I want to say that one more time. The color blue is associated, or it is equal to, extraterrestrial intelligence and UFO technology. So what do we have to back this up? Well, we have a program that was started under DARPA back in 1976, which is the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency under the jurisdiction of Lockheed Skunk Works Burbank, with Ben Rich heading up something called the HAVE Blue program. That was the program or prototype that procured the F-117A stealth fighter that flew in Desert Storm. Now, concurrently, Northrop was building a classified aircraft demonstrator, which was called Tacit Blue. That was the first aircraft to use a quad-redundant fly-by-wire flight control system with a side-scanning radar. It's the same radar that is used on the B-2 stealth bomber. Now, that aircraft was called Tacit Blue, okay? So let's just take those two together. What do you get, D, when you put those two programs together, knowing what we know about the color blue? Well, HAVE is very self-explanatory. Tacit means secret. So if you put those two together, Tacit Blue, HAVE Blue, what they're telling you is we, quote, secretly have UFO technology. That's what they're saying in their own code name. Now, D, I ask you this question. What was the name of the facility that Barry Goldwater asked Curtis LeMay when he was trying to get into it at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base?
The Blue Room.
The Blue Room. Exactly correct.
My God.
Okay, the Blue Room. Right. Now, when Barry Goldwater asked Curtis LeMay, General Curtis LeMay, he said, General LeMay, I know you've got a room at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base where you keep all this Roswell stuff, where you keep the debris and the bodies. Do you think I could get in there? And Curtis LeMay turned at him and said, damn it, Barry, don't you ever ask me that question again, because if you do, I'll have you court-martialed because I can't even get in there. That was the response that Barry Goldwater got when he asked Curtis LeMay this question. Now, moving on. The official color for the United Nations is blue, okay? The color for the Air Force is blue. The first 3 degrees of Freemasonry, D, are called the blue degrees. When you get past the blue degrees, you have the option to branch off into York Rite Freemasonry or Scottish Rite Freemasonry. The point is, the first 3 degrees are called the blue degrees. Now, D, I ask you this next question. What is the name of the military liaison team which is in charge of security and equipment removal at the UFO crash retrievals, D? Do you recall the name of the operation?
Right off the top of my head, I don't.
Okay, it is called the Blue Berets.
Oh, my goodness.
They're the ones in charge of the cleanup and security at UFO crash retrievals. Okay, now, when you get into the intelligence community, aliens are not called aliens, okay? They are called what's stated, quote, the blue bloods, okay? Aliens are called the blue bloods within the intelligence community. What is the name of the program that was started by the U.S. Air Force that was terminated in 1969, D?
Blue Book.
Project Blue Book.
Oh, my goodness.
Okay, now, if everyone in ufology, we're all united on this, we've been following the new ABC V series, okay? Now, the Vs have come down. They have a program called, quote, the Ambassadors of Peace Program, and they want all of us to join this, quote, Ambassador of Peace Program. If you look at the cover of the brochures that they're handing out to individuals, that cover, D, is blue.
Blue.
They're handing out blue brochures. Okay, now, next one, D. What is the name of the program that Dr. Wernher von Braun had told Carol Rosen? She stated that von Braun told her that there would be these generated threats, quote, threats, for us to build, quote, weapons of mass destruction. First, there would be wars. there would be an environmental threat, there would be an asteroid threat, then there would be something called terrorist or, quote, nations of concern. And then she told, and then he told her, von Braun told her, that there would be one final card that the elite would play. This would be their final chess move. Dee, what was the name of that program?
I don't remember the name of the program, but I know what it entailed.
Okay, it's called Project Blue Beam.
Blue Beam, thank you.
Project Blue Beam. Okay, now what's the point of all this? The point of all this is Bob Lazar said that when he was given his security badge to work at S4 on extraterrestrial flying saucers, that security badge had two vertically oriented stripes or bars running up the upper left-hand corner. The color of those bars were light blue and a darker blue. So there's that one. Now, when you take a ride from Area 51 to S4, they ship you in, believe it or not, a blue-colored bus, okay?
Oh, my.
So if you put all this together, okay, this color blue is associated with UFO technology and extraterrestrial intelligence. I mean, we've got some type of verification to back this up. Now, to complete this picture, he said that the bottom or lower deck of this vehicle was shaped, was composed of multiple hexagonal-shaped honeycomb panels. Okay, keep that in mind. Now, if you look at the bottom of the motherships, the 29 motherships that we see on the new VABC series, they have the same exact hexagonal-shaped honeycomb panels. Now, that's consistent with
kidding.
Yes, take a look.
And unfortunately, I have to stop you there.
We're out of time.
I'm so sorry. I want to hear more of this. You're making connections that just are mind-boggling. We're definitely have to have you back so we can
that'd be great,
more Dee. Cases and discuss this even more and get into the TR3Bs and
absolutely.
And all that. One quick question. Are you going to be doing any speaking engagements?
I'm doing one January 20th and 21st in Los Angeles and Orange County, California.
Oh, fantastic. And
yes.
Everybody can find out more info on your Facebook.
Absolutely. All the illustrations and things that we've talked about tonight are on my Facebook page, yes.
Okay, and on that note, unfortunately, we have to end. I want to thank you again for joining us tonight. I've enjoyed this thoroughly. I've learned so much tonight.
Thank you, Dee, so much. Really appreciate it.
Okay, and unfortunately, we are all out of time for tonight. I want to thank everyone for tuning in and also thank all of those who joined us in the Pal Talk Auditorium. Stay tuned for Voice of the People, hosted by November Hansen. Her guests tonight will be filmmakers Andrew Barnes and Paul I believe that's pronounced Tate or Tat. There will be no live broadcasts next week due to the upcoming Thanksgiving holiday. So please join us again Saturday, December 5th on UFO Paranormal Radio Network for another live episode of Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis. Until then, keep an eye to the sky. Good night, everyone.